your hair color, your blood type. You probably don't mind people knowing these things about you, but what about your likelihood of having a fatal disease, or your desire to have blonde-haired children? All of a sudden, the world is your genetic oyster. Whom would you trust with this information? Could you even trust yourself? Tonight, live from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, whose DNA is unlocking your genetic secrets? That's tonight on the agenda.
Tonight on the agenda with Steve Paikin.
At first, it was believed mapping the human genome would give us a blueprint of ourselves. Instead, the genetic code is only a guidepost.
Breaking the code.
This research could lead to new therapies for heart disease, diabetes, and cancer.
From Dolly the sheep.
Dolly was cloned using the cells of an adult sheep.
To devastating diseases.
They used DNA to reproduce the proteins that are produced by HIV.
Spilling our genetic secrets.
They're looking for inherited traits passed on from relatives.
A benefit to mankind?
It'll give you power over your own life instead of just randomly waiting for symptoms to appear.
Or playing with fire.
Knowing who's at risk for depression or cancer could open the door to discrimination.
Animal cloning shows the procedure for humans is unsafe.
The evidence would really suggest that the offspring will be abnormal.
Whose DNA is it?
DNA tests traced his roots to Cameroon. He was related to a freed slave.
Part 3 of The Agenda at the Q2C, Quantum to Cosmos Festival. That's tonight on The Agenda.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin. Funding for The Agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Valley Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Nice to have you back with us at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and the Q2C Festival, Quantum to Cosmos Festival, here in Waterloo, Ontario. On Monday night, we asked whether, given the state of the Earth, humans should attempt to colonize space. Last night, we took a closer look at the effects of living in an increasingly wired world. And tonight, with our discussion about genetics, we continue our week-long specials on some of the most intriguing scientific discussions of the day. As always, we've got a full house here tonight at the Perimeter Institute. And for those of you at home, you can join the program as well. Our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner, is once again hosting a live chat on our Inside Agenda blog. There's Mike. We're live streaming tonight's broadcast at our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Simply go to our homepage for all the information, festival details, much more, including web-exclusive video from some of the sharpest minds in science. Now, tonight's topic, are we ready to come face-to-face with our innermost genetic secrets? And whom can we trust with this knowledge? Here tonight to help us debate this question, Sean B. Carroll, geneticist at the University of Wisconsin and the author of Remarkable Creatures. Mark Gerstein, biophysicist at Yale University. Margaret Somerville, ethicist at McGill University. Jim Pillow, Chief Financial Officer of Arctic DX, a Canadian-based medical diagnostics company. And there's Carolyn Abraham, medical reporter with the Globe and Mail. It's great to have everybody along tonight, some familiar faces who've been on the program before, and some guests up from the States. We're happy to have you all here this evening for Whose DNA Is It Anyway? $3 billion. $3 billion to sequence the genome originally. In the year 2000, $30,000. Today, $1,000. Jim Pillow, the cost has obviously gone way, way down as we've gotten better and better at this. But for $1,000, what do you get for that?
Well, there's a couple of different models that people are working with in the genetic testing space now, Steve. There's the most recent model to be evolving is called direct-to-consumer testing. So there are a number of companies, particularly in the United States, that are pursuing this model, and they will look at your DNA for $1,000, or for $400 or for $100,000. And for that range of cost, we'll provide you with essentially a laundry list of potential ailments that you might suffer from. They might look at your ancestry for you.
You don't get the same thing for $100 you do for $100,000,
I hope. No, you don't get the same thing. No. For $100,000, there are companies that will fly you down to New York so you can interview your genetic results with a panel of physicians who are experts in their field of endeavor. So that's one model that is coming to the fore right now. The other model is more traditional diagnostic model where genetic testing or genetic diagnostics form part of a toolkit that a doctor would use in a particular specialty to look at your risk of a disease or some as a diagnostic aid in some other tests that they might do. So really there's the two models.
Okay, Mark, let me follow up with you. We can retrieve this information, we can store it, but do we know what to make of it?
Well, I think we're trying to figure out what to make of it now. I mean, it's a big research undertaking. There's a lot of things we can know from the genome and from our DNA now, but I think there's a lot of things that we don't know that we're trying to determine, and I think the question is very much open.
So, and how would you answer it?
Well, I would say that, you know, there's certain things that you can get from your genome and from your DNA now that will give you some sense about your risk of contracting certain diseases and your relatedness to other people, but they certainly won't be the complete picture. And I think that, you know, that will be filled in the future.
Margaret, many of our viewers, probably many people in the audience may remember the New York Times Magazine did a piece with Steven Pinker, originally from Canada, the Harvard psychologist who had his entire genome analyzed. And he says at this stage of the game, we cannot even clearly identify the set of genes responsible for something as simple as height. What is it that still has to be in place for us to know which genes are responsible for how tall we are, for example?
Steve, I haven't got a clue.
Nobody does, apparently, at the moment.
I mean, where I would be interested in that question is when we know what those genes are, is it ethically acceptable to manipulate them? And
You got some advice on that?
Well, I think if you were abnormally tall or short, and so therefore in some way you could say that this was a medical intervention, it would raise many less ethical problems than if you simply have a parent. I mean, one of the things that's often discussed is, well, the parent wants a famous basketball player for a son, so they want to have their genes manipulated so that they'll be very tall. I think that's not acceptable for a whole lot of reasons.
Which we'll get into over the course of the evening. Sean, how about you? Any idea how we start to figure out which genes are responsible for getting you as a next member of the Toronto Raptors?
Sure. Well, I think in terms of figuring out what genes do, biologists have been doing this for about 40 years. Our capabilities keep increasing, but you got to understand the genome is just a parts list. It's like getting 20,000 parts. Imagine, you know, those barbecue grills you try to assemble. If you shook it out and there were 20,000 parts, you know, we still don't quite know the operating instructions. So we're identifying things in ones and twos and threes, sort of trait by trait, disease by disease. So I wouldn't want to give the impression that, you know, we've suddenly been stumped. It's just, it's a massive undertaking to now work from this parts list to figuring out all these different dimensions of human biology. And it's an enormous enterprise that lots of people are engaged in.
Got a guess as to how far away we are from finding that information out?
You mean information like height or something
yeah.
like that? Well, we certainly know some things that contribute to height, but we can't look at the recipe and say, well, you're going to be 6 foot two. A big part of that also is the amount of calories you get as a kid, right? So people haven't changed genetically in the last 200 years in any significant way, but we're all bigger, and that has to do with cheap calories. So maybe something else we'll talk about tonight is that you're not just hardwired by your genes, but your environment has a big influence on your life.
Sure. Carolyn, one of the, I guess, the consumer angles of this thing is that some people have expressed concern that there will be unscrupulous companies that are out there that may try to make money from people who are essentially hypochondriacs. Is that a warranted concern?
Yes, I mean, I think there has a term that has been coined called the worried well. So all of these people who, you know, have some spare change around, rush off to try these tests, find out they may get this, they may be at a higher risk of that, they may know that they could run a certain resistance to this disease, that disease, you know, decide it's okay to stop for cheeseburgers every Friday, and think that they can now live their life according to what they've learned by these tests. But I think to the point that Sean was making, what I think is being learned generally as a whole in the field with every incremental study that associates one gene type with a particular trait or disease is that DNA is a bit like a script and real life is a bit like the performance. And we just don't know what makes that gap be filled by what particular elements shape, you know, whether or not someone reads their lines precisely so, or whether someone's, you know, great at, you know, performing and someone's not. And the list of variables that go into that are quite long. And so I think that it seems to me from where I sit is that the more they're learning, the more they realize that there is to learn, and that genes really do only tell a part of that picture. And even the picture itself right now is very hard to interpret. Hmm.
Jim, let me follow up with the business angle as well, which is that for all the promise that all of this new knowledge holds for us, diagnosing diseases that we never could imagine 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, making a go of it commercially has not really happened in a huge, widespread way for so many companies. A lot of people have lost a lot of money on this. How come?
Yes, I have it. I'm really loving the metaphors here, so I'm going to throw another metaphor out there. One of the ways that I think about the genetics is it's basically a dashboard of yourself. So you have a dashboard of yourself. And when the human genome was sequenced, there was a lot of promise around the fact that we might end up with a dashboard with an indicator indicating every part of our disease risk and our life and our height. And it turns out it's not really like that. So there were a few genes that were found that actually are on the dashboard and are very clear about what they indicate. And then there's a few discoveries that are more like warning lights. They tell you something's not quite right, but not, you know, really sure what it is, and it takes a lot of digging to figure out what that is. And a whole lot of the discoveries at this point are like little noises under the hood. And they could be 100 different things, they could be nothing, and you take it into the garage and the car doesn't make any noise anymore. So the repeatability of those studies and trying to figure out what's making those noises under the hood is a tremendous challenge and has been moving out of the private sphere into the public sphere, where the discoveries have been funded by public monies through organizations like Genome Canada. It's really a public endeavor.
So at the risk of torturing this metaphor even further,
yes,
even though we can take the car into the shop and it's only $100 or $1,000 for the oil change or whatever, the fact that it's cheap doesn't mean we're any further ahead to getting
Absolutely.
The information. Okay,
Absolutely.
Margaret.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on something Carolyn said about, you know, that everyone's turning into the worried well. Mm-hmm. Well, our basic presumption used to be that we were well until we went to the doctor or we felt sick and the doctor said, "You're sick." So we went around thinking, "I'm healthy, I'm well." One of my physician friends said to me the other day, he said, "You know, Margot, the well are only the undiagnosed sick." And so...
It's a different way of looking at it, isn't it?
So it's a complete reversal of the presumption. And I think we've got to worry about that in terms of what it does to our mental health as well. And, you know, our sense of hope and joy in life. I don't think it's just a neutral situation.
I presume you don't like that interpretation of things.
No, I like to think, you know, we're all fit and healthy. Even one day we're going to, as we say in Australia, drop off the perch.
Gotcha. You know? Let's move into some discussion about what we're calling a new transparency. Marco, go to you first on this. Different private companies own the rights to genetic markers for various diseases. There are ethical implications of all of that. Start us off on that discussion, if you would.
Well, you know, there's this sort of tension between, you know, wanting to foster innovation and foster all these biotechnology companies, and also the information being free and available to the public. And, you know, one of the big things behind the publicly funded Human Genome Project was to make the information free. It's a kind of blueprint for people, and there's this sense that everyone should kind of be able to partake in it. That said, of course, we also want to spur innovation and to spur companies. And so I think there is this big tension that has been in genomics and genetics for the past 10 or 15 years. And I don't think there's an easy way around that. I mean, I think for the companies to be able to make money, they have to have some sense of ownership of property or something like that. And I think that is an important thing. And how to kind of cordon that off properly is, you know, it's quite a challenge from a kind of legal and commercial perspective.
Sean, where do you come down on this public-private issue?
Well, I agree with a lot what Mark's saying. There's a lot of precedent for this. I mean, I think maybe because we're talking about our DNA that it's starting to feel very personal. But, you know, lots of very vital tests, were first inventions somewhere where people held companies held patents for a long period of time. You know, the new pregnancy test that came out based on monoclonal antibodies, you know, people could have said, oh my goodness, a small number of companies are going to be able to tell whether we're pregnant or not. But, you know, we got through that. And I think this balance between, you know, the patent law has always been balancing public interest and sort of, you know, commercial concerns, and that's why patents have a finite lifetime. So if you don't have the incentive, I know quite well from the biomedical community, these tests will never be developed. There has to be a commercial incentive or they just won't exist.
Margaret, you want to help us with the ethics on this one?
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult issue. You know, one of the ways that we talk about the genome in ethics is as the common heritage of humankind, that it belongs to all of us. And so with these tests, what is happening is that they're isolating a certain gene, and then that's being used to found the test. And there is a body of thought that thinks that at some basic level, that belongs to everybody, and that when you're using it in such a way that you're depriving people of being tested for very serious diseases. I mean, the one that was the first one where we had this problem was with the breast cancer gene, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And I think that we do need a compromise, and my colleagues here are correct. There has to be some profit in it, but I think that has to be at a secondary level, that gene belongs to everybody.
Hmm. Carolyn, where does the medical community come down on this as you've reported on it over the years?
Well, increasingly, as governments sort of withdraw funding for basic research, and this being a problem sort of for worldwide, I mean, the incentive has to be there. And increasingly, the kinds of disease genes that companies are chasing require enormous sums of cash, because you're talking about recruiting tens of thousands of people to find those genes. So on one hand, you can see how impossible it is to try and do those studies unless you have deep pockets. But on the other hand, I know in Ontario, for example, and in British Columbia, the whole issue over who would really be allowed to get those breast cancer genetic tests done was a very difficult issue, because it wasn't funded here for a long time. And there were long, long waits. And playing this story out in the real world meant that people basically had to come up with the funds themselves to have the tests done privately. And only by sort of describing it, and this is obviously in a publicly funded healthcare system, as an experimental test and being part of a grander research project, were they able to continue without facing legal action. And this policy can differ from country to country to country. And if, as Margot was saying, we are talking about something that is common to us all, and if there is some sort of international body, and there are international human genetic societies that meet, I think that there's a need, and there's going to be a growing need to reach some kind of consensus around it. Well, if those tests are going to be prohibitive in cost.
Sure. Jim, this is your business, so before I do the follow-up question, take 20 seconds and tell us what it is you guys actually do.
We're in the business of commercializing genetic discovery. So we don't do the basic research to discover the markers and link them to a disease, but once an institution has discovered markers, we would license those in and then commercialize them via medical channels, in our particular case, by working with doctors, and offer them out into the healthcare system at a cost that returns to the public system that did the discoveries, as well as to the company that's commercializing the test.
That's the clear thing here. So you guys, you do recognize the role that the public sector plays in all of this, and how does it get its rewards in your situation?
Well, in fact, because I believe that there's a lot of, well, there is a huge amount of public investment in making the original genetic discoveries through the Human Genome Project and Genome Canada, particularly here. The way the institutions who have that money invested, along potentially with their own funds, recover their investment is by taking a royalty on the ultimate use of the product in the marketplace. So a portion of the funds on every test that's run goes back to the institution who made the discovery to replenish funds for future discoveries.
Mark, is that an appropriate balance where you're coming from?
Sure, I think it's an appropriate balance. Mm-hmm. But one thing I do want to point out is that the discussion so far has really been, I think, predicated on this idea of, you know, sort of single gene, a single test, sort of focusing on that. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of success in that in genetics in the past, but I think a lot of people believe that's not really where the future's going, and very much there's going to be many, many different genes and parts of the genome that are going to interact together as a system to give about lots of traits, such as height and so forth. And the reason we can't actually explain a lot of things now is we have to figure out how these systems come together. And I think thinking about this kind of ownership type of thought process in the framework of a much larger kind of system of interacting markers or large portions of our genome and even the environment coming together is a little bit different than kind of fixating on the breast cancer gene or something.
Okay, fair enough. But let me do one more follow-up with you. And I'm presuming that you guys are working on something like this. A desktop DNA analyzer that any doctor who wanted to would have in his or her office, able to analyze your blood so specifically that you, the doctor, could then order up a prescription that would be singularly particular to that person's needs. How far away are we from that?
Oh my goodness. The scientists in the scientists might have some thoughts about the research that would be involved in getting there. That certainly is the intention of personalized medicine, which has as its core the genetic underpinnings of each individual. So that, and there are examples on the market now where people's ability to use a therapeutic, their internal processes for using a therapeutic, is different from individual to individual, and it affects the dosing that that individual gets and how they're going to react to the drug and whether that drug is toxic to them. So there are elements of them that are already in place, but as Mark was saying, those were kind of the low-hanging fruit. And now we're going to get into much more complex systems to
okay,
try to figure out
okay, before you go there, though, Sean, is that a positive example of
the development? This is technology people want. So let's take, for example, cancer therapeutics, which started as a very blunt instrument with lots and lots of side effects. So the trend in cancer therapy is much more targeted therapy, knowing something about the genetic basis of an individual tumor. And as we've learned about what sort of genes are aberrant in various types of cancers, that is shaping exactly how therapy is going. And you know, since all of us, our families are generally affected by this disease in one way or another, this is definitely a technology we want. It's saying once the disease is there, how can we be smarter in therapy? It's a little bit different than, you know, looking decades down the road and saying, well, do you have a 1-5% chance of developing the tumor? The crisis is there. We want this information. We got to have it now.
Okay, you're leading me to the next place I want to go, and Margaret, I'll do that with you. Once we have the ability to have all of this knowledge about us, are there some circumstances where, thanks, but we don't want to know? Where ethically would we not want to know the answers to some of these questions, which we'll soon be able to have answers to?
Well, I can give you one example that we've already wrestled with, and that is the gene for Huntington's chorea, which is an inherited disease, and the people who have it die somewhere between their mid-30s and late 40s, and with horrible mental degeneration. And it's basically accepted that it's wrong to test any child for that gene.
How come?
Because it's something where the person themselves has the right to decide that they do or don't want to know whether or not they've got it, that they want to live their life, for instance, not knowing until physical symptoms or mental symptoms become apparent. I mean, I once had a situation where I was consulted on this where there were twins and who were up for adoption, and the people who were putting them, the people organizing the adoption, were absolutely in turmoil about should they tell any prospective adoptive parents that they knew that there was Huntington's chorea in the family. And then if the people, and what happened in the end was that people said they wouldn't take the children unless they knew that they didn't have the gene. And they decided still not to do the test. And eventually somebody said, I don't mind, they're still children, they still need looking after, and we'll adopt them, which is a wonderful thing. But, you know, you can get some very, very difficult situations with this.
Carolyn, anything else on that list? When would you rather not know?
Well, I think that ultimately this is all going to come down to what you yourself can live with. I mean, I know that as these tests, these recreational personal genetics tests have become, you know, more available, have become cheaper, more popular, people have talked about whether or not there should be some sort of limit on the companies that sell them. And I think I have to side with the idea that it's a bit paternalistic. I think people are, you know, we live in an internet world. They can research as much as they like. If they are interested in these tests, sometimes no amount of information is going to change what people think about how they think. And so they're going to get these tests, and maybe there'll be a sign-off, and they can tell people what they want to know and what they don't want to know, much the way that you know, James Watson recently said, yes, you can sequence me, but I don't want to know about my risk for Alzheimer's. Whether or not those risks are, you know, absolute or well understood or interpreted or not. But yeah, there are all kinds of concerns. But I think going, what Sean and Mark were both saying about sort of where the future is headed and what related to your point about height, it's just so hard to draw a direct line between any kind of a genetic trait or a trait and a gene. Like, there's, you know, all manner of different configurations that could say, yes, you will get diabetes, or no, you won't.
Let me pick up with Sean on one of those examples you just gave. Alzheimer's, for example. Why would you not want to know that you're predisposed to have Alzheimer's, so potentially you could change your exercise, change the way you diet, change the way you live, maybe live healthier longer? Wouldn't you want to know that?
Well, if you're asking me personally, yeah, I probably would want to know. You know, but this human nature is a tricky business, right? I know those extra cheeseburgers aren't good for me, but I'm going to eat them anyway, okay? So there's a certain amount of risk we're willing to take where we think that the risk is remote and the immediate benefit outweighs it. That's one thing. But if you, for example, have Alzheimer's in your family, if you think this might have to do with preparing your children, you know, to or your growing children to make preparations and things like this, I think a lot of people might make that choice to know if there's a risk. But here's where you come in another area. We're talking about risk. We're not so good with factoring risks in our lives. If we say you have a 5% risk of this or a 7% risk of this, everybody kind of computes that a little bit differently. I mean, look how long it's taken to change smoking habits, where the risk there, not just of cancer, but of very serious lung disease, was blatantly obvious. Very hard to change those habits. So some of these risks we're talking about are much smaller risks, statistically speaking, than risks that we've all faced and heard about before and had to make lifestyle choices about and not necessarily made very good ones.
Right. Margaret?
Yeah, but you gave a scenario where there was something you could do about it. Let's take control, and control reduces fear. But the situations in a lot of these cases, there's nothing you can do about it. You might kid yourself that, you know, doing exercise or eating healthily is going to help, but what if it probably doesn't, I would think, for something like Alzheimer's. So that, I think that's, I mean, if we accept that we've got a limited lifespan, and if we think we want to live that as fully and as richly and as joyfully as possible, I think there are some situations where you'd be able to achieve that to a higher degree if you didn't have this knowledge than if you did.
Right.
And I think that has to be a personal decision about whether or not you want the knowledge.
Jim?
There was a study commissioned by the federal government in 2003 in anticipation of this great wave of genetic discoveries to find out what average Canadians thought about being tested for and obtaining genetic information. And it turns out that 95% of people at that time, that was 6 years ago, for themselves and on behalf of their children, fully 89%, would be interested in receiving genetic information if it was a test for a specific condition, if the result provided some definitive information about the risk, and if there was something that could be done about the disease. So those were the three conditions that the Canadian population at that time established as prerequisites to being interested in receiving genetic testing.
Gotcha. Carolyn.
Yeah, one thing I would add to this is the whole idea of genetics, though, and making personal decisions about what you want to know is further complicated by the fact of that you share your genome with members of your family.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you want to know, but your sister doesn't want to know, and your brother doesn't want to know, but now you know. And now, do your parents want to know? Or do your kids want to know? Do you tell them? is knowing the same as them knowing, it introduces sort of ethical quandaries, I think, that, you know, people haven't even begun to compute.
Margaret, another word on that?
Yeah, Carolyn's absolutely right, and that's one of the big dilemmas that we're trying to look at. I mean, what about if somebody comes along and gets tested and there is something there, and it is something that you would think might benefit or would benefit other members in the family to know about. First thing that can happen is that the person themselves says to the doctor, I prohibit you from telling anyone else. What does the doctor do then? And or alternatively, they say, yes, tell everybody else, but they haven't volunteered for a test. So, you know, it's very, very, very tricky.
You've given us lots to think about here, and in the meantime, I want to go to the back of the room. Mike Miner is way back there in the cheap seats, and he is handling the live blogging tonight for us at tvo.org/theagenda. Mike, come on in with the report and tell us what's up.
Well, we have about a couple of hundred people on here in our lively live chat. We threw out a casual poll. Around 60% of them want their DNA mapped. And we have most of the conversation about the ethical questions here. KEH says that he thinks our technology outpaces our ability to make ethically sound decisions, and there's a lot of concern about what the private industry is going to do with their research. In a very Canadian way, they want to know about healthcare costs and what the government can do to play a role in this. Norm asked a question where these things have sort of tipped into the world of almost online dating, wanting to know, will there be a time when potential partners will use DNA analysis as a compatibility test for desired traits.
Brave new world.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, you're still on this. We keep this going even past 9 o'clock, right? A little bit
all
past
night.
Nine. Okay, let's just remind everybody we're about halfway through the program. We are live tonight from the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario. We're all part of the Quantum to Cosmos Festival, Q2C, a worldwide gathering of some of the leading scientists and scientific thinkers anywhere. If you can't be with us here, you can always do what we just showed you. Join Mike Miner on the Fifth Column blog at tvo.org/theagenda. He's standing by to chat right now. You'll find that on our Inside Agenda blog. You can also email us at theagenda@tvo.org, or follow us on twitter.com/theagenda and use the hashtag #YourAgenda. And while you're there, we've got some other things for you to check out as well. All of this week's agenda broadcasts, as well as web-exclusive video of guests from the Quantum to Cosmos Festival using their expertise to imagine the future. All that, plus complete festival coverage in live streaming video and video on demand online on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Mark, let me pick up with you. I heard Carolyn a few minutes ago talk about we live in an internet age right now. Everything's out there. Talk to us about how much transparency, once we have this information, we should, you know, expect to have to live with. How much is private, how much won't be private, a whole bunch of issues there to deal with.
Well, I think, you know, the genome and DNA information is digital information. You know, in some sense, it's very similar to the digital information people have in their other life streams, their, you know, photos, financial records, whatnot, that they carry with them through life. And so in a certain sense, you can deal with it in the same way, but of course it's very special information because it's so fundamental to a person's being. And so, you know, I think it's important that people don't treat it the same way. I mean, I think people are increasingly very carefree with the way they share information on the internet, you know, through social networking and all sorts of things. And I think that there's an ease that you can do that with DNA information, but people might pause at doing that for the reason that was mentioned earlier, that you're often compromising information about your family members, and a lot of times you don't really even understand the information you're potentially sharing, you know, now or in the future, and so it potentially could be somewhat deleterious.
A lot of sports fans watch this program, even though we don't do much sports. Can you imagine a future where general managers who are about to draft a certain player want the genomic readout of that player to find out if they're predisposed to breaking bones, getting injured, who knows? I mean, is that possible in the future?
Definitely. I mean, I think that one could imagine that, you know, in the future, when one looks at a baseball card, one might have, in addition to the height and weight, you'd have alleles of, you know, that have been associated with various sports characteristics. And you could easily imagine this future, and it's both a good and a bad future. And, you know, I think that, you know, one, and certainly there's a tremendous incentive in competitive sports and certain things like that to find out about people's physical disposition. So I think you could easily imagine that.
Margaret.
Yeah, I was consulted by a sports mad nation who wanted to give sports scholarships to 11-year-olds. And what they wanted to do was test them for whether they had short twitch muscle genes or long twitch muscle genes. Now, the reason is...
What does that mean?
Well, I don't really know. All I know is what, you know, I was told about this. But the short twitch muscle genes make you a fantastic sprinter. And the long twitch muscle genes make you a wonderful marathon runner. So they didn't want to waste their money training a guy with short twitch for marathon or vice versa. And, you know, and I sort of, my opinion was that I didn't think you should be genetically testing 11-year-olds and awarding scholarships on the basis of genetic information. And they said, but why is it different? Because we look at these kids and we try to guess and we look at what they can already do. And that's really a result of their genes. And that wasn't very easy to answer. But I think there is I think we've got an intuitive reaction that there's a difference between this. Really, it's a very invasive technology, even though it's not physically invasive. It's what Mark said. It goes to the very being of who you are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all genetically unique except for identical twins. So that's very kind of special, important information. And I think we have to be very careful at the moment. I'd use what we call a precautionary principle. Sort of be prudent, wise ethical restraint until we're certain that we're not going to do a lot of harm with what we can do.
Okay. Carolyn, you are, let's give you a little plug for what you're up to right now. You're working okay. on a book on all this, right?
Well, specifically, I'm using genetic testing to try and solve a couple of family mysteries. So I'm using it for an investigation of ancestry.
Why'd you want to do this?
I always knew that I would get around to doing some genealogy work. I just imagined I'd be, you know, older, retired, time on my hands. But when I realized that the state of science is at a place where the kinds of mysteries that, you know, I was interested in looking at could be tackled with, you know, testing on the Y chromosome, which is different than looking at, you know, your entire genome, and more reliable, I would say, and knowing what it means in terms of relatedness to people, I decided to do that.
Have you found out anything conclusive yet?
Yes.
What'd you find out?
Well, I have, insofar as my family goes, I have managed to sort of solve the stories of my two, my maternal great-grandfather and my paternal great-grandfather, where they came from, and in one case, that has also led me to, you know, to who they were, and it's been a long process, and so I've had sort of a very personal experience in doing personal genetic testing, and know that whatever it is you do when you talk about DNA testing, you're not just talking about you.
And are you happier to have these secrets unlocked now?
Yes, I am. Very much so. Yeah.
Okay. Let's quote from Stephen Hawking here. We're in the place that has a relationship with Stephen Hawking, so it seems like a reasonable thing to do. Here he is from a few years ago. There's a sick joke that the reason we haven't been visited by aliens is that when a civilization reaches our stage of development, it becomes unstable and destroys itself. The long-term survival of the human race will be safe only if we spread out into space and then to other stars. This won't happen for at least 100 years, so we have to be very careful. Perhaps we must hope that genetic engineering will make us wise and less aggressive. Mark, to you, what would it entail for us to gain the knowledge of which genes will make us, as Stephen says, wiser and less aggressive?
Well, I definitely think people are trying to correlate genes and systems of genes with various behaviors and mental conditions. And I do believe that people are going to find some fairly good correlations. I mean, they've already found some correlations in relation to, say, autism. And, you know, I do believe that they will be able to perhaps identify certain genes that are associated with certain extreme behaviors. Now, where they go from there is another question.
Would that be worthy to find out what might make us wiser and less aggressive?
I think that would be worthy to do, yes.
Sean, what do you think?
I think the answer is in social justice. I don't think it's in genetics. I think that humans have pretty equal potential for these unwanted behaviors, and that these unwanted behaviors are largely a result of environment, and that when people have a decent standard of living and a good prospect of raising their children to a ripe age, that those aggressive behaviors and things are less pronounced.
So don't look to science and genetics to solve everything.
Correct.
Particularly this.
Yes.
In the audience, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I'm a strong advocate for as far as donating my body parts in terms of those types of things, in terms of promoting that for science. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, I have control over that by signing that off, but do I have control over how my DNA is used? And if I do, what are the methods in terms of that?
Okay, who wants in on that one? Don't everybody shout at once. Okay, Margaret, go ahead.
Well, to the extent that there's experimentation involved, then you have to have what's called the informed consent of the person whose sample is used to produce the DNA. But once the DNA is detached from you, and particularly if it's anonymous and it can't be linked back to you, there are provisions in both in ethics and sometimes in law that says researchers can use that without further permission. So, I mean, one of the things that, in fact, we're looking in Quebec at the moment at changing the Quebec Civil Code just for this reason, because if you have to get informed consent and you don't yet know the future tests you would want to do, you can't get informed consent to something you don't know about. So that the Quebec is looking at making it easier for researchers to use that without specific informed consent, but with lots of safeguards around it.
Is that the way it should be?
I think so, yes. Yeah. Yes, I do.
Okay. Question back here, please. Hi.
You made a very definitive comment with respect to Huntington's chorea, and I can think of many genetic diseases that would be beneficial for people to know before they choose to have children. I'd like your comment on that.
How about screening? Yes. You're thinking what in particular?
Well, Huntington's chorea is a perfect example of a disease that you know of earlier in life before you decide on whether you'd like to pass that disease on. It's
Tay-Sachs as well, I guess, is one.
There's quite a few of them, clearly. I mean, MS, yeah. I think we're very close to sorting out. We've been doing it with the trisomy for many years. There are a lot of decisions that are made with respect to planned parenting, and although they may be decisions that you make for or against, isn't that information valuable?
Well, I think there's a difference between testing the potential parents who obviously they have to want to be tested and giving them that information, and they decide not to take the chance of having a child with that condition. Although some people, what they're doing in those circumstances are using in vitro fertilization and then using a process called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis where they test the embryo. But that, of course, raises lots of ethical questions too, because that's a form of eugenics. And quite a lot of people think that's wrong, and some people think it's acceptable. As well, there have been for some time programs for genetic recessive diseases where both people have to have the gene before the child will actually be at risk of that condition. Tay-Sachs is one of those. And there have been programs put in place where, for instance, people who are at risk of Tay-Sachs can go to, for instance, in the Jewish community in Montreal, certain rabbis know the test results for young people, and they will tell them whether this person they are thinking of marrying is somebody where that's a good idea or not a good idea. So I think we can help people within certain limits.
Okay, Sean, let's be clear though here, Sean, about what we're talking about. We're not talking about genetic testing before having children in order to see whether or not you're going to have blue eyes and blonde hair. We're trying to, I think the example is, avoid a profoundly debilitating illness or disease or something that would kill a child before it turned 5 years old. Is that acceptable to do in your view?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've been doing it. I think lots of people can make that choice, right? It's still a choice. You can decide not to have that information, but I think the majority of people will choose to have that information if they can have it, again, by the criteria Jim laid out, that if it's a reliable test and you can take some action and you're going to calculate your risk of whether or not your child might be afflicted. Mm-hmm. And so that era is here. For the diseases that have a single gene of large effect and if they're where a mutant gene is of high risk or virtual certainty, if it's inherited in particular conditions, that the disease is going to develop, and that disease is debilitating, perhaps with early mortality, we're already there. I think the gray area has come where the test is not that definitive, the risks are smaller than certain, and the weighing is very, very hard for individuals to do. It's a much tougher calculation.
Okay, back here, please. Hi.
There's been a lot of discussion about risk and people making decisions around their personal risk and stuff. I'm wondering what the insurance companies are thinking about assessment of risk.
Hmm. Okay. Carolyn, you know anything about this? What the insurance industry is saying?
Well, one of the things I found interesting about this is obviously a big and old concern, and there aren't any laws preventing insurance companies now from finding out, is I've heard from a few doctors that say, if my patients have gone ahead and done this testing, I ask them please not to tell me what the results of their tests are, because when their insurance company phones me, I don't want to be under pressure to reveal the results of tests that I can't vouch for. But then again, on the other hand, speaking of Craig Venter, who is one of the handful of people in the world to have his entire genome sequenced, the scientists who analyzed his DNA backwards and forwards actually came to the conclusion that they weren't able actually to identify any more risks by having his genome and compared to just knowing what his family history was. They told the same stories. So in some respects, some people say that, you know, it's quite overblown.
So he could have saved his money?
Is it going to save his money to know?
He should have saved his money then?
He should have saved his money.
He should have saved his money. Okay. Back here, please.
We've talked about how complex this issue is ethically, but my question is, with this genetic testing being developed so rapidly, how's the field of genetic counseling being developed, and how well matched is it to the speed at which genetic testing is being developed?
Okay. Margaret, you got a thought on that? Margaret,
yeah.
Then Sean, maybe?
Well, there's been a lot of work gone into developing genetic counseling, and it's extremely important. There's also a lot of concern about how you do it most ethically. I mean, most genetic counselors think it should be non-directive counseling, which means that you don't tell the person what to do, and most ethicists think the same thing. Rather, you try to lay the situation out for the person. But some of the research shows that no matter how, you know, well-intentioned you are in that way, it's awfully hard not to sometimes, you know, influence people, even perhaps subtly, and you don't know, you know, that you're doing it. But it's a very important area. Very
Sean,
important.
Sean, how much progress we made on this?
Yeah, well, I can plug my own university. We have a long-standing genetic counselor training program, and I've taught thousands of undergraduate students genetics, and I know there's a big interest among young people in going into this field. So whichever way you look at it, we're creating a demand for that skill set, for understanding the science, understanding the medicine, understanding the ethical issues. We need to train a population of people skilled just as we would trade, you know, nurses and physicians to be able to deal with this information.
Jim, I wonder if there's a business opening there.
There is. A matter of fact, most of the testing companies offer genetic counseling as part of their service. But the demand for genetic testing, particularly as those tests are available now, work their way into the more general medical community. There's a requirement for those physicians who are not specifically trained in genetics to be able to explain the ramifications of the test to the individual who's receiving those results. And I think that is actually a barrier to the adoption of genetic testing commercially and in the healthcare system.
Okay. Carolyn, let me try this with you. What can we say today about the relationship between knowledge of genetics and life extension?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I think that there's probably been enough known about, dosage of drugs. I think that that's been safe. And if you can, drug interactions and adverse reactions to drugs are big killers. And I think that we are like well underway in terms of figuring out, you know, dosages and what drugs can't be tolerated by certain people. I don't think the tests are right there, so I think that contributes to life advancement. I think that the issue, the examples that have been given already in terms of single disease genes and whether or not you actually start a life knowing, if you're talking about the collective. Has that changed? Yes. I think the incidence of Tay-Sachs and things like thalassemia in Montreal, because of these kinds of screening programs, have dropped by about 90% plus. In terms of has actually finding single disease genes led to many cures? No, not on that front. I think we're still a long way off. And I think in terms of the preventative action that we might or might not take because of risks, possible risks in our genome, are good to take whether or not you knew that you carried that possible risk factor or you didn't. So I don't think yet that genetics in the personal medicine field has borne out its potential by any stretch.
Okay, Margaret?
Yeah, what Carolyn's just described is what the guys called the transhumanists, who think we're on our way to a post-human future through changing our genes. That's life extension. In other words, you get your life and then you try to extend it as long as possible. But they also talk about another intervention that's called age retardation. And what they're postulating there is that we're finding the genes for aging that will be able to go in and manipulate those genes so that, for example, you'll reach puberty around 50 years of age and you'll be a young adult around 90. And, I sometimes think some of us still are, but...
I was going to say, don't the boomers think that already?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And they think that this is something that's going to be very attractive to the general public and will make the general public very favorable to genetics. I think that remains to be seen.
We've got about three and a half minutes to go here, and I want to read one more quote. This is from the American political theorist Michael Sandel, who wrote, who lectured earlier this year. One of the blessings, he said, of seeing ourselves as creatures of nature or God or fortune is that we aren't wholly responsible for the way we are. The more we become masters of our genetic endowments, the greater burden we bear for the talents we have and the way we perform. Mark, let me start with you on this. Is it possible that we may know more than we should?
I certainly think that's the case. I mean, I think for a lot of people it would be a huge burden perhaps living up to their genetic heritage or perhaps overcoming what they perceive as their genetic disabilities. And I think that's a huge burden to give someone at the beginning of their life, you can imagine.
Sean?
Yeah, I'm concerned about the notion of that with 20,000 genes, if you're fully sequenced, you're going to know some genes that aren't working as well in you as they might in your neighbor, okay? What are you going to do with that information? And I think you have to know an awful lot of biology to really, deal with that. And that's more than most of us, I think, really want to deal with. I don't think all of us want to think that we're running around here genetically handicapped. It's a fact of genetics that all of us are carrying something that is not performing at the same level as the same gene in others. I think that'd be a big mistake. And I think we have to go back and understand, look, you were talking before about athletes. Look, I don't think if you genetically tested, I'll pick an American athlete, Larry Bird, he would have really scored high on the genetic test for basketball players. And one of my favorite baseball players is a fellow named Dustin Pedroia, 5'7" of the Boston Red Sox. There's a lot to be said for talent and hard work and discipline, et cetera, and how you're raised and the effort you put into things and the level of education, et cetera. And we don't really know how much our destiny is genetics and how much our destiny is determined by these other things. I think that's the knowledge we want to have.
Jim, quick word on this?
I think people who are cognizant of their limitations, explicitly aware of their limitations, are probably not going to behave differently whether they know those are genetic or environmental.
Probably not going to behave differently?
Probably not going to behave differently.
Probably not going to. Okay. Carolyn, a word on that?
Yeah, actually, just picking right up from what Jim said, I think what would concern me about sort of the general knowledge and knowing too much is that you underestimate yourself and everyone else around you because of it.
Margaret, last 30 seconds to you.
What that brings, I think what Professor Sandel says is absolutely right, that what it brings up is whether we buy into what's called genetic reductionism, that we're nothing more than our genes, that genes are us, that we're gene machines, or whether we think there's some mystery to being human and that although our genes are very important, they're the substrate on which the human us exists. And I very much believe in the second version. I think there's more to being human than simply our genes.
Gotcha. Thanks so much to all five of you for coming to Waterloo tonight to help us with this most interesting topic. It's our third of five programs here at the Perimeter Institute, and it's so great of all of you to join us. Thanks so much. And we also want to thank our audience for being here as well this evening, taking time out of their schedules to join us here at the Institute. It's been great having you alongside and joining us with your questions as well. Now, online tonight, for more information about tonight's guests and a link to the study, The Perils of Cognitive Enhancement, web-exclusive video of leading scientists answering the question, where do you see our future in the next 50 to 100 years? And complete Q2C festival coverage, go to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Tonight's program was produced by Vodek Schemberg. Thanks so much, Vodek. You can read his post called Carried Away with DNA. That's on our Inside Agenda blog, also online at tvo.org/theagenda. Okay, please stay with us. We're going to be right back with a look at tomorrow night's program right after this.
Do the terms polyhedrons, cubes, and axes cause uncontrollable sweats? Find out who is responsible for making high school math a classroom nightmare.
My field probably wouldn't even exist if it weren't for Coxeter. He was the one shining star for a long time pushing classical geometry.
The things that turned him on when he was 96 were the same sort of things that turned him on when he was 16.
The Man Who Saved Geometry, tonight at 10.
For 10 days in October, Waterloo will be the center of the scientific universe. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival will bring the world's brightest minds together to discuss everything from quarks to black holes. TVO is proud to be the official broadcaster of the event. The agenda will come to you live from the Perimeter Institute during the week of October 19th through 23rd. Our guests will be world-renowned leaders in their fields, giving us great insight into some of the foremost science-related questions of the day. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival on the agenda. Plan on being a part of it, October 19th through 23rd at 8 p.m.
Funding for the agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Vale Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
So Monday night, when we did our first program here, Mike Miner told us we had twice as much traffic in our chat room online on our homepage as per normal. And then last night, Mike told us we had three times as much traffic as we usually get. So what do you think we're doing tonight? Yes, four times as much traffic online. And keep the conversation going. Mike is hosting an online chat at our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Go check it out. Weigh in with your views. We'd be happy to hear them. And that is the agenda for Wednesday, October 21st, 2009. Tomorrow night, we'll continue our Quantum to Cosmos coverage with a look at the robotics revolution. How will the latest advancements in robotics change our lives? And here's a hint. Some are saying that artificial intelligence will put us on an accelerated evolutionary path. Hope you can come back for that discussion. For complete coverage of Q2C, special features including video on demand, our Ask a Scientist segments, and information regarding TVO's complete scientific literacy programming, visit our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda, and click on the Q2C link. And a reminder as well, go to our homepage and get tickets for next week's Monk Center season premiere. That's it for us tonight. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org, and we'll see you again tomorrow night from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo.